In speaking with different communities who are also refugees and immigrants and forcibly displaced people, what I would hear too is that they said, I've always had this dream. It's not just strictly associated to being here as a hyphen American. It's more universal than being specific to one region or one demographic of the world.
How does your view of the world change when you've seen your home collapse in war, forced to leave with only the shirt on your back and your toddler in your arms? How does this experience shape how you navigate life in a country where what we have so often defines who we are? Welcome to Complexified, where religion and politics collide with real life. I'm Amanda Henderson. For the past several weeks, we've been tracing this myth, the American dream, to better understand the many stories we who live in the United States hold, and to ask how these stories shape our understanding of the past and how we can imagine the future. At the start of this series, I shared the stories I've been told about my own family history, about my great-grandparents homesteading in the Arizona desert. My questions and reflections that surfaced have brought me into relationships with people from all different backgrounds. Through these friendships, I've learned more about both my own place in this story of the United States, as well as how different worldviews, systems, and laws that we inherit shape our daily lives and continue to live in our bones. I've been fascinated by the way our immigration laws in the U.S. are tied up in both national interest as well as assumptions about who is more or less valuable. Inclusion in the United States and access to this idea of the American dream is shaped by our histories and by international politics. We are a global community. Between 1924 and 1965, immigration to the United States was limited to people who came from only Northern European countries under the national origin laws that were blatantly xenophobic and racist and explicitly excluded people of Asian descent. And then in 1965, in the midst of the civil rights movement and ideological battles with communism playing out in Cuba and Vietnam, there was this heightened disconnect between these images of a welcoming, inclusive nation and a reality that was plagued by racism, Jim Crow laws, and exclusionary immigration restrictions. The National Origins Immigration Policy finally came to an end in 1965 with the passing of the Hart-Celler Immigration Act. I promise I'm not going to go into too much detail about this act because this is the core case study of my dissertation work, so I am slightly obsessed with this policy. The Hart-Celler Immigration Act opened immigration beyond Northern Europe while simultaneously adding a number cap on immigration from Latin America for the first time, as well as a total cap on worldwide immigration to the United States. This is still the immigration policy that stands after more than 50 years. There are clearly many issues with it, and if you have a few hours to kill, just ask me about it, and I'm happy to tell you all the details. But I think it's important to know that this policy is quietly in the backdrop of our next few conversations. Battles over what can seem to be philosophical ideologies or economic systems aren't just arguments that play out in theory, but have real lasting impacts in our lives and become wrapped up in our own desires for safety, belonging, home, and even for the latest and greatest technologies or entertainment and joy. These seemingly disparate things are actually connected. This becomes more and more clear to me when I listen to the stories of those who have been physically displaced by war, who have had nothing, and sought something more. Today, we welcome Na Vuong Sandoval. Na came to the U.S. when she was 3 years old with her parents, fleeing the war in Vietnam after the fall of Saigon in the late 1970s. Growing up a refugee, Na now takes that experience to support refugees all over the world, to help them tell their stories, to advocate for humane policies, and to educate people about the obstacles faced by those who are forced to leave their homes. I first met Na nearly 10 years ago on the steps of the Colorado State Capitol at a World Refugee Celebration where we both spoke and then danced. That's right, we danced because that's what you do on World Refugee Day. I admired Na from the start. She currently serves as the United States Refugee Advisory Board Project Manager, and her professional experience has included serving at the Colorado Department of Law and the State Homeland Security Office. I welcome Na to our studio at ILEF School of Theology the morning after she was named a civil rights champion by the Anti-Defamation League. And I asked her what comes to mind when she hears the term American Dream.
So when I hear these words, it connotates a lot of things, but I know even the origins of it has really metamorphosized throughout the years too. You know, if you look back in how it had came up into the American conversation and lingo, it was early on in the, I wouldn't say turn of the century, but probably the early 1900s is where it originated from. I believe it was a book by, I believe, James Truslow Adams in 31. And the premise of that was to ensure that everyone had equal opportunities and access to basic attributes that would really help them to have a more fulfilling life, whether that be liberty, whether that be justice, whether that be opportunity. And now it has evolved into something I believe is so much different than what its original intent is. And in a lot of ways, it's very telling of what some of the overarching and larger community priorities are as well. Because I think for many, it connotates something that is an accumulation of more physical things versus more intangible things, where it was initially created to focus on more of the aspirational components that we aspire to have, whether it's freedom, whether it's safety, whether it's security. Now it's more about larger, more tangible, more of the items to keep up with others, as a show of one's wealth. And it has evolved into something more about the capacity of your home, the type of vehicle that one drives, one's occupation, the kind of things that people may want to flaunt. You know, to some that might equate to self-worth. But
this keeping up with the Joneses kind of mentality has taken it over.
Yes. Yeah. So that to me is what comes to my mind as a refugee.
Tell me a bit more about that story, your story as a refugee. How do you experience this idea, this myth of the American dream?
For me, as a refugee who came over as a toddler, so my family and I were automatically thrust into a completely different culture. A culture that symbolized that pot of gold, that end of the rainbow type of host country. As most people view countries that are very wealthy, that are very industrious, that are very prosperous in a lot of ways. And I think for many who originate from another country, that is also something that is a predominant message that is being echoed in a lot of different spaces to strive for this dream, to strive to reach a certain threshold, to define one's self-worth and giving consideration as someone who has made it or someone who is worthy of being accepted into that particular society. So from that context, I believe that when you are in a position and you start off like we did, with absolutely nothing, because we've lost nothing when we fled our homeland due to war and persecution, it is very easy to get lost into that very loud message of being able to accomplish all of these things and really losing the sense of what's really important at the end of the day.
Do you remember that as a kid? Because you were little when you came.
It's such an overarching theme, I think, wherever you go, whether you were born in the United States or you're not. That's something I think has been ingrained in the psyche and the culture of North America and many parts of the world, too, I think, have gotten so adjusted to knowing that unless they meet these certain criteria of accomplishment, then you really haven't made it. So it's easy to get lost in that when that's part of this theme, that this messaging and this criteria in order for it to be accepted.
Hmm. Is there a story that represents that for you?
You know, what I had seen when we initially arrived was that owning a car was a really big deal. I mean, you know, even for people who are born here, car ownership is it's almost a milestone for many people, because now it gives you freedom to travel. It gives you freedom for independence. It gives you freedom to do as you wish, really, you know, and not be reliant on other people, not be reliant on public transit. So it gives you that mechanism.
What was your first car?
It was a hand-me-down. It was one of my parents' cars, because they upgraded to something just slightly newer.
Yes, that's where most of us start out, right?
I think it was like a Honda Accord. It was a Honda Accord. Uh-huh. Yeah, so not bad. And so I was just happy that I had anything. I was seeing everyone else driving, and you know, it being already in the minority for, in a lot of ways, and not having that mechanism, you know, in which to be independent. I think I was happy with anything. I would have been happy with a scooter, you know. I mean, honestly. So yes, it was a hand-me-down. You said that's the story of most people. So I'm glad to know.
Yeah, my first car was a 1985 white Nissan Sentra with these faux sheepskin covers with like my dad's smell permanently absorbed in the whole car because he had driven it for so long.
It brings back memories for sure.
It brings back memories. And you know, you talked about it, how easy it is to get sucked into that, especially when you come from a country or a culture where there isn't such excess. Do you remember coming to that awareness in yourself of, oh yeah, this might not actually be all it's cut out to be, this idea of more, 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 more?
Well, it's really interesting because I have relatives who reside all over the world. And when they visit us, they find it really astounding and bewildering that there is a TV in every room, that everyone has their own laptop. And you have to get the largest screen possible as opposed to what's really needed. So it's very apparent to folks who don't live here as well, the over excess of what it is we've accumulated through the years. And is it really necessary? Of course not. We can live on one laptop. We can live with one TV, of course. But since we can, why not, kind of mentality. There's a common thread throughout all of this. And where is this really coming from? You know, is it the marketing? Is it the culture? Is it the need to have more? Is it the competitiveness of human nature in general? So I don't know. It's just really interesting how things have evolved to ensuring that capitalism is kind of at the center of what defines a person. Yeah. More and more.
Yeah. Okay. This just got me thinking. So the country that your family fled from is Vietnam, and a lot of the justification for the Vietnam War was this fighting communism, right? And so it's really interesting that part of especially the time period of the 20th century and the mid-20th century on, this battle between capitalism and communism was at the heart and continues to be at the heart of a lot of different global fights, right? Oftentimes, refugees and people from communities where they have been legitimately oppressed are lured to see this idea of the United States as far superior because you can have anything and do anything and be anything. How do refugees experience that tension? And how does it feel to have other refugees exploited in so many ways around that?
I really appreciate that. It has so many layers to what you're saying. And a couple of things come to mind as I'm hearing you walk through the whole dichotomy between capitalism versus socialism versus communism, you know, and there's so many layers to that. It's interesting because people can go very far to one direction or the next when they're put in very extreme situations and experience so much trauma and experience so much hardship and atrocities that have been put in front of them that sometimes they go completely the opposite way just to ensure that there's no remnant of that memory or of that life or of the things that are associated with that. And so, and plus I think too, it's human nature, you know, this idea of hoarding, this idea of over excess is very real. There's shows about it all the time. There's even shows about it that people are seeking help because they can't, they don't have this, the self-control to be able to, you know, it's gotten so far. But I think there's a human tendency in all of us to do that. But I think for folks who have lost everything, and I hear this with people who survived the Depression too, is that that idea of making sure that you have some kind of surplus or some kind of inventory of resources just in case. You know, you hear of folks who survived the Depression or even war collecting like even like sugar packets when they go out to things. And you're like, what is going on? Well, you're bringing that home or like ketchup packets or whatever it is, you know, and you think, wow. And then the easy translation or interpretation to that is they're frugal, but it's really a survival mechanism that has been so instilled because they've been without for so long.
So children who've had hunger and insecurity, there's a noted and studied way that they have to just know that there's food nearby. And so helping them ensure that they know they will eat another meal is a primary way to just providing enough of that sense of safety and survival to be able to function every day.
Yeah, it's very primal.
It's interesting.
It's very primal.
It's very primal. Yeah. It's interesting. And I've been as researching this idea of the American dream and knowing that it was first written in this book in 1931. And the first thing I thought was that was immediately after the Depression, the Great Depression. And so how did that idea shape this move of the idea of the American dream, even though it started as a very much more ideological rather than material goods and, you know, car and house and the ways that so many of us think about it today. But it's interesting that those two things kind of came to be at the same time, the recovery from the Great Depression and the idea of the myth of the American dream.
Absolutely. And to some people, it's still a myth. It's unattainable for some people too. And I feel that that seems to be a further reach as we progress through some of the things that we're seeing with economic mobility and with being able to self-sustain with all of the various things that are considered real barriers to particular communities. And you're absolutely right. I mean, that could be a byproduct of what had happened that people had seen. And it's really, it's so much has changed though. So much has changed since you look at the origins, a lot of things that have happened. But I think it's always something that I find interesting too, is when in speaking with different communities who are also refugees and immigrants and forcibly displaced people, what I would hear too is that they said, I've always had this dream. It's not just strictly associated to being here as a hyphen American. I've always had that dream. I've always
aspired. No matter where they were.
Yes. So it was more universal than being specific to one region or one demographic of the world.
Part of your work that you are doing right now is with global refugees and you have the opportunity to meet people from all over the world who are both refugees from all different countries as well as settling in countries outside the United States. How do people think about the idea of the United States compared to going to the UK to resettle or France?
I feel that this very, very specific concept is very specific to North America. In other nations, it's defined by relationships. It's defined by intangible things. And it's not the apex of what it is that you reach. I feel like it's a continual progression of betterment and improvement to what you have, but not to reach it and say, yes, I've made it now, because I've attained these material things. In speaking with people all across the globe, the core values of what we would like to happen, that we would like to achieve for fulfillment, self-fulfillment, there is less emphasis on all of the material accumulation that is strongly emphasized here.
As someone who works globally and internationally and often representing refugees from the United States, how do you hold the tension of our history as the United States that is rooted in the genocide of indigenous people and enslavement of African people in our founding?
I believe the best approach is to confront the historical challenges head on. Whether a person chooses to deny it or accept it, it still happened. The truth is always going to be the truth. Whether we turn a blind eye to it or we choose to have a conversation about it, I think the rest of the world is very well aware of the history of the United States, and they are fully aware that I also live in the United States in trying to bring forward and advocate for issues that may not be supported in various spaces. But I also think that people understand that if there is not an intentionality to what it is that they want to move forward, then it just becomes that. It just becomes something that is mentioned or in conversation, but not really impactfulness or intentionalness to correct these problematic situations. And everyone is aware. I don't think there is someone who has been surprised at what had happened. But that tells you, too, how aware people are of history, in particular, U.S. history, who don't live here in the United States.
Outside the United States. The people in the United States are less aware probably than the people outside sometimes.
Yes. I've seen that happen. And even in places where I travel to, even within the U.S., when I mentioned certain historical context, people are very surprised to hear me talking about it and having a conversation because they have a very different perspective about it. I mean, I brought up internment camps, and there was a couple that asked me something about, weren't those just farms? Didn't people just farm there? And I said, well, no, because there were barbed wire and there were firearms pointed in toward them to keep them inside these, you know, these encaged areas, basically. Someone even call it concentration camps because you couldn't freely move around, even though most of them were U.S. citizens, a good portion of them were U.S. citizens. And that, again, really reminds me and is a reaffirmation when I do speak to people who live in different parts of the world, how well-versed they are in what is happening here. And most of our media here is focused strictly on the United States, if you take a look at it, which, whether we know it or not, is highly influential on the way that we view the rest of the world.
One of the other amazing things that you have the gifts to do is to train and support refugees to be able to use their own voice, to tell their story, and to help acclimate to the realities of living in the United States. As you look forward, what do you hope for the future, for the lives of those who are coming to the United States today as refugees?
I love that question because it It speaks about a community I deeply care about, for one. And it also speaks about striking the balance, not discouraging people too much and not getting their, you know, a very non-realistic, unreachable perspective as well. I asked the same exact question a couple weeks ago when I had spoken to an author who is an asylum seeker. And he speaks nationally. He's a public speaker. And he also wrote a book about being a queer asylum seeker. And I asked him the same question. I said, what do you tell the youth that you interact with to not discourage them too much? Or do you encourage them? I mean, what is your... And he mentioned something about, well, I want to make sure that they don't get too... I want to encourage them to the point where they're going to want to do something to better themselves and not discourage them too much. Of course, I want people to acclimate and integrate into their host countries, wherever that may be. But I also think it's important not for them not to lose themselves in the process too. And what the core values of and what is important to them and their family and their ancestors have been forever, before any atrocity had occurred, because that is going to bring them the most, I believe, the most reachable dream and the most meaningful dream is to stay true and authentic to what truly brings you that joy at the end of the day, as opposed to getting distracted by the loud noise of what you should be doing when really it may not be representative of them at all. You know, and if anything, that might even set them back because now there's so much in debt from all of these things that they're trying to accumulate and getting distracted by keeping up with everyone, and that they are not even doing things for the betterment of themselves. So that's where my perspective is from. When someone holds something so dear that they are willing to speak about it in a way that exposes so much of who they are and so much of the experiences that they have that are very emotional, and willing to find those commonalities with people with various backgrounds in making sure that we are doing our best to provide them the things that we all dream about. Back to just, I would call it our dream, you know, the human dream. In what it is that we all want to accomplish. I don't want them to lose that and get distracted by a name or a word, because naming something that is not representative of you, I think sets you up for things that are really not meaningful or superficial.
Mm-hmm. Such wise advice. Wisdom that we all need. I am so grateful. Thank you, Nah, for sharing your story and yourself, not only with us and our community at Complexified, but on the global stage and the local stage and all of the places that you shine light and bring wisdom and bring others up with you. So thank you.
Thank you so much. I'm so grateful to spend this time with you. Thank you for having me.
Before we close, I want to share a poem from Mariela Saavedra Carquin. Mariela came to the U.S. as a child with her parents from Peru. Her parents sought opportunity and a better life for their children. Mariela writes of the complex realities of loss that are an inevitable part of coming and going.
What do I mean when I say I remember? I don't think two people ever mean it to mean the same thing. I don't think one person ever means it to mean the same thing. I mean that remembering each time is different. And each time you lose a little and you gain a little something. I have a picture of this one time. I dig through the archive in my mind and sort, and this is the one I find. I'm sure my father has his and my sister has hers and my mom, well, what becomes of the archive when that person passes? What parts can you still find and hold? We are getting off a plane. I'm wearing this white dress, white pantyhose and frilly socks and dressy shoes, because that's what you do. That's how I'll dress my future, my imagined kids. like mommy did. My dad is holding me as we go down the plane steps. I don't think he'd ever let me fall. I don't think. My sister's there too. She can walk, they've decided. And mommy looks straight ahead. I'm nervous because I know what is to come, and she doesn't. I couldn't warn them either way, because reality doesn't work like that. It goes forward. At least that's what they tell us. That forward means go, that forward means living, that forward means real. But I still want to see possibility. Not whether I could rewind, but whether I could gain control. How I might touch time, reach out, and maybe hold some history. I can almost see her hopes, her future, in this picture. What she meant, what happened later. A stream of that when I close my eyes. A Rolodex you can stop anywhere and hold one, feel its edges. Daddy's face doesn't know. He will later say, this is not how it was supposed to happen. He called it a tragedy, which annoyed my little sister. Tragedy. What is that when you go back in time? Was the tragedy in the leaving or in the arriving?
We are grateful to Nat for coming and joining us and sharing her story and for the work she does each day to support people who are displaced and seeking home and survival and belonging all over the world. In our next episode, I can't wait for you to hear from Dr. Albert Hernandez, a professor of Christian history who came to the United States from Cuba in his mother's belly. As he says, he was made in Cuba and born in the U.S. Albert brings insight into the tensions and complexity of never feeling fully Cuban and not feeling fully American. You don't want to miss it. Thanks again for joining us. Check out our website at complexified.org and sign up for our monthly newsletter to continue the conversation. If anything inspired you or sparked your curiosity, please share it with a friend. And also, don't forget to like, subscribe, and leave us a review on your favorite podcast app. Complexified comes to you from the Institute for Religion, Politics, and Culture at ILEF School of Theology. Working hard behind the scenes is our student intern, Josh Perez. Thanks to our sound engineer, Jasmine Hunjin, and the team at Podcast Allies. I'm Amanda Henderson.